Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Occupy America, Occupy Interview. And this is episode 36. The title of this show is Occupy Fusion. I'm delighted to introduce our guest. Hamid, please introduce yourself.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, Terry, and a very timely conversation. My name is Hamid Khan. I'm based out of Los Angeles in Southern California, and my primary work is to expose and research and organize against the surveillance industrial complex, primarily focusing on the Los Angeles Police Department, which is a massive apparatus of militarized policing with a huge architectural surveillance. So that's the work that I've been doing. We've been able to unpack a lot of the stuff that Los Angeles Police Department does, and then it becomes a model for the rest of the country. And what we recently saw in Ferguson was an example of how policing all around this country is now going beyond, this whole notion of militarization. And by that, what I mean is that while the scenes that we saw with body armors and tanks rolling and AR-15s and assault rifles and stun grenades and tear gases and rubber bullets and dogs and everything else, I think we need to really start unpacking this thing and draw parallels with the U.S. military itself. And then once we are done with that, then what we find out is that police departments in the United States, and Ferguson was a classic example, are operating now more as an occupying force, more in the mold of a counterinsurgency force, than the much claimed and touted and the illusion of community policing and protect and serve narrative that we hear all the time. I'll give you a few quick examples that when you look at the economic power that they have and the political power that they have and the structural firepower that they have and then the whole cultural deference that they operate in. L.A., for example, the LAPD controls anywhere from 55% to 57% of the city's general budget, and where, you know, even in the economic meltdown that a lot of services were scaled back, LAPD continues to have the budget and has all the money that it needs. And on top of that, then what we also see is the federal grants that keep on pouring in. And, you know, we all know that since the formation of the Department of Homeland Security, I would rather say it's more of a Department of Homeland Insecurity as far as, you know, the people of the United States are concerned. You see this massive pools of money constantly coming in. Then when you look at the private money, and I think that is something that we tend to overlook at times, through the police foundations and the donation, you see a whole lot of private money. And most recently what we found out in L.A., for example, that it's the same companies who are getting hundreds of millions of dollars of contracts for surveillance equipment are also donating money into the police foundation, which then makes its way into police agencies itself. So, you know, that goes to show that how much money the U.S. military, even when we had on a national level the economic meltdown and where on every day where people have lost jobs and people have lost businesses and people have lost homes, where, you know, basic necessities and basic services are being cut back, but yet monies are being poured into wage wars all over the world. So now if you draw those parallels, there's a war being waged on the people at home as well. Then when you look at the political power of the police departments, I mean, just in L.A. in the city council, there's a total of 15 members of the city council who make all the decisions. Out of them, three or four are cops or former cops. And then they just need three extra votes or four extra votes to get any, either stop anything that is going to challenge the policies and the monies that go in, or they sail through. So the level of political power is massive as well. And then looking at the whole structural power, you know, while there's a lot of conversation around the Department of Defense program, 1033 and the passage of a bill, legislation that allowed access of armaments and tactical weaponry since 1996 to be sent over to law enforcement, you know, what you see is that, and I'll quickly run through it for a couple seconds if you'd allow me, where, you know, you look at the tanks and the helicopters and SWAT and AR-15s and assault rifles and tear gas and stun grenades, rubber bullets, and on and on and on. And then when you link it up with the whole architecture of surveillance, where they have the automatic license plate readers, where even whenever you're driving, wherever you go, they're pinpointing, they're finding out what your location is, where you socialize, who you go see, where you're going for dinner, where what movies you go see, where you live, where you work. And then there's this trap wire technology. These are surveillance cameras that pick up your body image in real time on the street, and immediately that is uploaded into databases and shipped over to these massive secret data centers like fusion centers. And they have the Stingray technology, which mimics cell phone towers, and in essence, it lays a net around a certain area and then picks up everything that is going on all the cell phones. And it's not only that, then it permanently records the unique ID that each cell phone has attached to it. Then you're looking at high-definition cameras, which was used very effectively during Occupy and to monitor people as well. And then, of course, one of the biggest programs that they have is called the Suspicious Activity Reporting Program, where now a simple act of taking a photograph in public will land you into a secret database, which is then uploaded into the fusion centers. And fusion centers, just to let your audience know, are basically warehouses of information gathering, storing, and sharing. They are these actual locations. There's about 85 around the country, and I believe they may have 3 or 4 in Missouri as well. California has 5 or 6 of those. And the way they operate is they're right amongst our midst, that anything that you're doing, for example, I said taking photographs in public, using binoculars, using video cameras, even sitting around and taking notes or drawing diagrams, you know, all that information is uploaded. A secret file known as a suspicious activity report gets opened, and that information is then uploaded into these databases, into these warehouses called fusion centers, and from there it's accessible by every other local, federal, regional law enforcement agencies, tribal police, campus police, transit police, including every other federal government and state government department, including Social Security Administration, Housing and Urban Development, Wildlife and Fisheries, some that you would think, like, you know, there would be pretty benign when it comes to counterterrorism and national security. And then a huge infiltration and information sharing with private corporations. I mean, I'm reminded of a Washington Post study that came out in July of 2010, which at that time had already identified 1,938 corporations which were already involved in information gathering and sharing. So in essence, and then we have the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, and then we have the Joint Regional Intelligence Center, which is the official name of the Fusion Center in Los Angeles, which happens to be one of the biggest ones in the country. So what you have is just kind of taking a step back and looking at this massive, you know, power and information gathering. It really goes to show that what exactly is happening. I mean, why do they need this thing? And of course, you know, I mean, it's anybody's guess, but, you know, we saw what happened with Occupy. We saw when people protested, people demanded. But what's also interesting about that is that before the first tents went up in Zuccotti Park in New York in September, already by July, there was this whole coalition, you know, called the Domestic Security something. I mean, they come up with these funky names as well. Where the FBI, the Homeland Security, and the on all the financial institutions had come together to map out that how they're going to deal with this protest that was emerging. So, you know, that's a lot there, but that's where we are, and that's the work that we are doing in Los Angeles.
We've got about 10 minutes left in this Introduction to Fusion 101 section, and I do want to clarify, this is a we had Jamie Garcia from your organization, and she also ran us through Eyes Over Compton. And if we could we get a real quick refresher on that, and the link to that show will be available on backup because our server has been damaged, but it's there. Can you give us a real quick Eyes Over Compton overview? That was truly chilling.
Yeah, certainly. So let me just equate that, and this is one of our key organizers, Jamie Garcia of the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition. She was speaking about where on the city of Compton they had experimented with a Cessna airplane which circled Compton for 2 weeks, about 8 to 10 hours a day, and basically, you know, looking over and testing these extremely high-powered cameras. And I'm not very technologically savvy with these things, but every movement of each person, cars, persons, you know, just anything that was going on in the city of Compton was being picked up by these cameras. But what was interesting was that this operation was being conducted by the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. What's interesting is that the city government of Compton didn't even know that this was going on. So the mayor of Compton was taken by surprise, the city manager was taken by surprise, and of course the people of Compton became, you know, laboratory rats, basically, like, you know, that how we are, our lives have become like these labs for them to test these things. But I want to link that with what is now moved into this whole use of drones. And that is what the next issue is, and that's what our current fight in Los Angeles is, and now LAPD wants to start using drones in Los Angeles. They already got 2 drones from the Seattle Police Department, but mind you, the Seattle folks, the community over there, rose up and rejected the use of drones, so the mayor was forced to send them out, and they quote-unquote gifted those because L.A. becomes a dumping ground. So, you know, all the
use it or lose it.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So that's where our fight is right now, but the drones are coming. I mean, basically, they're here. And we also need to know very carefully that how they're bringing these drones under the guise of restrictions that they will need some warrants, they will need this and that, but we all know that is just smoke and mirror, because this is what we call mission creep, that where a claim is made at the beginning of launching of a policy and said this is going to be limited. And it reminds us how SWAT got started, that where initially, and SWAT also comes from L.A. as well, our present to that we gave to the rest of the country, that where in 1968 this program was launched to primarily deal with barricades and hostage situations. But now, just this in June, this report came out that 79% of the SWAT is being used to deliver some basic warrants, and people's homes and doors are being broken down. So mission creep is a huge issue. So for us, you know, there is no legislation, there is no policy or protocol that we agree with, because in our imagination and people's imagination, I mean, basically drones, they either surveil or they kill or they crash. I mean, there's a report from the U.S. military itself that, again, Washington Post put out about 2 months ago, through extensive research through the Freedom of Information Act, and came out that 400 of U.S. military's own drones have fallen out of the sky. And the title of the report by itself says, "When Drones Fall Out of the Sky." So, you know, I mean, when we think of public safety, we need to be really looking at it through a very critical lens and start demanding answers and rejecting these things.
We're about 15 minutes into the show. I did want to touch again on when Compton had their lab rat experiment done on them. They did not know at the time. Would it be reasonable to assume that if St. Louis has experiments going on, we might not necessarily know in real time?
Absolutely not. I mean, absolutely not. I mean, how did even St. Louis and residents of Ferguson and the residents of St. Louis know that the police department is getting minesweepers and tanks and all the armaments? So let's even look at that how many people, what was the community input that the police department is going to be armed to the teeth?
Well, they know they're there now. That's certainly.
Exactly. So that's exactly out. Like all of a sudden this is thrust on us. And, using acoustic devices to stop protesting, I mean, that is, if you remember, they used these devices when they attacked Panama, when Noriega was brought in, and they used these devices. So that's what, I mean, how the war abroad comes and becomes a war at home. So I'm reminded that when they were using these acoustic devices constantly on protesters in St. Louis and Ferguson, you know, this is as if like this, I mean, so it was clearly an example that a war has been waged on the people, and we will use every tactics, every device possible that is experimented in war zones of overseas and bring them home, because now we are going to turn them into occupied territories.
I also wanted to, if we could, get you to give us a little bit of a refresher on the fusion centers were instrumental, according to documentation, not up for grabs. This is documented, it's history, instrumental in driving Occupy underground. These guys are not a joke. This is not a game. Can you tell us a little bit on that?
Right. So fusion centers and these things came out through actual documentation. There was about 4,000 documents that finally were released. And the way the fusion centers operate are that, again, these are a partnership between the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, the FBI, and local and state and regional law enforcement agencies. The budget of the fusion centers is close to 25 to 28% comes from the Department of Homeland Security, and the rest of that is picked up by the states themselves. So in essence, what these fusion centers are, that if, let's say, for example, the one in St. Louis on Forsyth Street or Jefferson City and other places in Missouri, so what you will have is at any time, analysts and the FBI agents and U.S. Attorney's Office and Department of Homeland Security and Department of Justice and your local law enforcement agencies partnering together, where all the information, all the data that is gathered through various means, whether it's through electronic technology, whether it's through human technology, whether it's through, you know, infiltrators, whether it's through informants, that information is then uploaded into these databases, and what they claim is that it goes through a vetting process. And mind you that originally the fusion centers were slated to be doing intelligence gathering for counterterrorism and national security. But a U.S. Senate's own audit of a subcommittee that was led by Senators Carl Levin of Michigan and Tom Coburn of Oklahoma released a report in October of 2012 saying that intelligence gathering at fusion centers, and I'm quoting directly from the report, was useless, irrelevant, outdated, duplicative, potential violation of Privacy Act protections, and on and on and on. Washington Post did a report in that and called them as pools of ineptitude. So in essence, what is happening is that, let's say, Terry, you're out there, you're taking a photograph, your information is picked up, it is put in a suspicious activity report, is filed, they claim they do some vetting to see whether there's any nexus to terrorism or any other criminal activity, then it is sent to the fusion center where, again, it goes through a second phase of vetting as well, and from there it is uploaded into these databases. The problem is that when the LAPD chief of counterterrorism was asked that if they have had anything happen as a result of the information that is shipped into these fusion centers, all he said was there's a lot of white noise, but an occasional gold nugget. But then he couldn't point to a single conviction that came out of this gold nugget. But what happens is, in return, that because your information is accessible by private corporations, by every other agency, so anytime you go anywhere, you are flagged as a suspicious person. Somebody may be doing an employment background check on you. Somebody may be just while you're traveling, you may be just flagged, and you could be monitored and followed. And then they get to keep this information, even when they say that, you know, there is no nexus to terrorism or criminal activity. LAPD on the local level wants to keep that information now for 10 years, but at the fusion centers, the FBI can retain your information in their databases for 30 years. So in essence, what we have now is this huge compilation of our private information that is going into these fusion centers, and the fusion centers are really at the crux of where all this intelligence gathering is going. The NSA, which has been gathering information on everybody, works through the National Counterterrorism Center, which oversees these fusion centers as well, and NSA was sharing information on people with the NCTC, the National Counterterrorism Center, which in return was then sending it to fusion centers as well. So not only is our information, so there's multiple ways that this information is being gathered, and then from there, that information gets picked up on individuals, and a lot of operations get coordinated out of that as well. And we saw that what happened during Occupy, but even before Occupy as well, there are cases where in state of Washington where actually a contractor, the Fusion Center, had infiltrated an anti-war group which was protesting some of the military installations and was busted as a result of that. And there's been a big case that has been going on as well. I mean, the whole issue of people who are supporter of Rand Paul were deemed as potential terrorists as well by these fusion centers. So, you know, just in your own state in Missouri, you know, there have been several other incidents as well. So I think this is something, this is huge, this is extremely dangerous. And when we look at the federal government accountability office, they released a report just last year in March of 2013 saying that the suspicious activity reporting program, which I was speaking about earlier, which is really at the heart of the Fusion Center as well, or one of the key programs, is now, which started out of Los Angeles in March of 2008, is now in 46 states, in two U.S. territories, out of the 18,000 law enforcement agencies around the country, 14,200 have already incorporated that into this program. Out of the estimated 800,000 police force in the country, close to 300,000 have already been trained. So, you know, and one of the biggest issues with this is that the standard that they are using is extremely dangerous. And I'll quickly quote that they define suspicious activity as, and I quote, observed behavior reasonably indicative of pre-operational planning of criminal and or terrorist activity. So when you break it down that somebody's observing a behavior, a cop is observing a behavior, which reasonably indicates there is no standard of probable cause, there is no criminal predicate. It reasonably indicates of pre-operation that you may be thinking of doing something that could relate to terrorist or criminal activity. So welcome to the world of speculative policing, and that's where this is going.
We're at 22 minutes into the show, 23 minutes into the show, and that brings us into this next section. What is your message to St. Louis? You've already pointed out that Compton had their experiment running and was unaware it was even going on. I've been passing you tweets that I'm seeing from St. Louis from people on the ground. I don't know whether you're picking up much of the information from the mainstream media, but I'm guessing not. Tell me, what's the message for St. Louis, please?
Well, first of all, I'm really honored to be just sharing my thoughts and my reflections on these issues with the folks up in St. Louis. I'm also extremely, extremely just humbled and inspired by the power and the resilience that the communities have been showing. I mean, it's just really phenomenal that in the face of some of the most dire and violent heavy-handedness of law enforcement and brutality of law enforcement as well, I mean, the communities, I mean, I salute them, really. I mean, folks in Ferguson have really set an example of what resilience is all about, and how do we just stare this kind of a state violence, and how do we really just expose this police state to its fullest. So I think that has been one of the first things that has happened, is that people did not take it down sitting. People did not just kind of cower under this assault. People didn't back away. It was the community. I mean, you know, we all talk about organizing and grassroots organizing and all this fancy nonprofit industrial complex and this and that and everything else. This is what, this to me, is a model of what grassroots organizing is. It was spontaneous. But there was a common thread that weaved through, and that common thread was like, no, you will not intimidate us. You will not silence us because you are violating our basic human rights, and we will stand up to you, and we will expose you, and we will push you back, and we will fight you. So I think that's the first thing of a huge, not just a lesson learned, but a reminder of where power really lies. Because I think the other piece that it also goes to show that this kind of power that we saw projection of tactical weaponry and armaments, this is always the power that is used by bullies and cowards. I mean, we've always seen them because they need to protect themselves. So where these people are standing, they're unarmed. So I think that is something I want to say that. Now, having said that, I also want to offer whatever, experiences and research and analysis and whatever we bring to the table as well. I mean, living in Los Angeles, having lived in Los Angeles for many years, having been doing this work, Los Angeles is sometimes considered ground zero for all the tactics and everything else that has been developed and operationalized by law enforcement, and which is then used as a model for the rest of the country as well. So we would love to speak to folks in St. Louis area as well, talk to them about it, help them, whatever little bit resources that we have information sharing. So I think what we need to do is there has to be sort of a cross-regional alliances, a cross-regional conversation that need to develop as well. And we'd be happy to engage in these cross-regional conversation. For us also, and I think we would like to really have those folks be a model for our communities as well, and communities in Los Angeles share their experiences that how do they fight back, how do they resist, how are they supporting what is happening in Ferguson. It is the same thing. I mean, it's quite interesting that as Ferguson was going on, during the same time period, a young 18-year-old man was shot and killed by LAPD, Ezell Ford. Within the same week, a homeless person in LA Skid Row downtown area who had a history of mental health and was used to climbing up these billboards because the person had a history of that. LAPD came out, and knowing that this person has a mental health history, instead of bringing the SMART team that deals with these kind of issues, they brought in SWAT. And finally, this guy was waving his shirt, and he was coming down. LAPD tasered him. He fell, broke his neck, and died. Then the third incident, you may have seen that a grandma was beaten up by a California Highway Patrolman on the Santa Monica Freeway. So I think when we look at these things, this is something that is going all across the country, but, what has happened in Ferguson has become a model. So my message to folks in Ferguson is that, we would love to talk to you more, but also, beware that, this kind of experimentation that is going on of heavy-handedness and violence and brutality goes to show that this is the kind of policing that we should be expecting, which really looks at us as the enemy, and which really looks at us and our communities as occupy zones.
One of the things I got back in touch with you because basically I was almost I really knew almost nothing about fusion centers, which is basically, in retrospect, probably what they're exactly designed for. Now the focus has turned, and I've been trying to send you tweets that are showing what the harassment that's being carried out in an organized fashion. Can you offer any words of advice to St. Louis on that?
Well, I mean, so you're right. I mean, these are all, for example, one of the largest fusion centers in the country is here in Los Angeles County. And so we've already held two protests over there, and both of them, they put it in a lockdown. They shut it down because the community, the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, organized. One was back in December of 2012, and the second one we have this April of 2014. I think that's when Jamie had spoken to you about it.
But I believe so.
But what's interesting about that is that this is co-located in a building that also has a Social Security office as well. So we sent a delegation in to submit a Public Records Act to get the information from the Fusion Center. First, they basically came out and they said, well, this is not a government office. And they had the seal right there, and they had the seal of all the law enforcement agencies right there as well. So they just lied, just blatantly lied to your face. And then they forcefully then removed our delegation, and then they put the whole building in a shutdown as well. So the point I'm trying to get to is that there's a lot of smoke and mirror and masking of these tactics and operations that is going on. So I would very strongly suggest, and again, we would be happy to speak to folks up there as well, that, you know, people need to really get organized and, you know, take this incredible energy that residents in St. Louis and Ferguson have shown, that part of that energy, that how do we then go after and expose in a very methodical way the structures that lie within us as well. Because it is through these very structures that now what is happening is that everything that has happened as a result of the protests, everybody's information has been gathered by these agencies. Everybody is now in their databases. Everybody is now through the video cameras. Everybody is now through the electronic the technology that they use, like people's cell phone numbers, people who are live streaming. Everybody is now a moving target. So now, in essence, in a way that now as we have become moving targets, then obviously, you know, what happens to those targets as well and how they get targeted for further enforcement and further criminalization. So I would even argue and take it a step further that it sometimes these issues become much more critical than what we see, that no, it is that once this thing is hopefully, you know, whatever comes out of this thing, it would be to the long-term benefit of the community, but the community really needs to stay very alert. They need to be staying alert. They need to be, people need to be very thoroughly filing Public Records Act. People need to be very thoroughly filing Freedom of Information Act, to finding out that what information has been gathered during these protests that will be uploaded into databases, which then can be used against people not just when their routine traffic stop is made or not just like, you know, somebody does something, even in a very benign way when you're traveling and when you're seeking employment, or you're going anywhere, going fishing, or you're doing this and that or the other. So that's what the purpose of information gathering is, to make sure that the state, that they, what they do is that they constantly monitor us. And then this information gathering, quite frankly, becomes is used as a policy of social control, that how, you know, people's lives are manipulated and then they're controlled so people can be monitored and constantly silenced. So I would very strongly suggest to see and reach out to your local, maybe, I don't know if the ACLU is active there or not, where the residents over there need to come together and start demanding answers as to what information have you gathered on us, and we need to have access to all that information.
This stuff really will be brought to light. There's no question about that. There is a process that actually you guys have shown successes there, right?
Yeah, we've been able to, just expose quite a bit of that. And through that, just very slowly, very methodically, on a very basic level, we've been engaging people into, so for example, some of the stuff through research, through Public Records Act, through actual finding out that what these things we've been able to expose, and this is where it becomes really critical, Terry, that, you know, right now the claim is counterterrorism. Well, when you cut through the facade, what you find out is that, no, it's everyday policing. So, for example, the LAPD's own Inspector General did an audit on the suspicious activity reporting program, which was slated for counterterrorism. But then what we find out is that the largest number, so out of a four-month sample on race, we find out that 82% of these suspicious activity reports have been opened up on individuals who were identified as non-white. And the largest sample was in African Americans. So racial profiling becomes a key as well. And the other partner programs or companion programs they have, you may see these signs saying, see something, say something. So you see them on buses and airplanes and trains and everywhere else and shopping centers. That is also a part of the suspicious activity reporting program. So this is where they're actively seeking community informants and community snitches to call upon each other. Well, through Public Records Act, we found out that 72% of the data that they gave us, 72% didn't even meet basic guidelines that the cops were telling communities. So people were actively calling out each other and unnecessarily just kind of claiming them to be suspicious. And these people's information was going into these databases. So we are able to expose that as well. So when in return, what had happened is then we started a campaign and started going to local neighborhood councils, which really are truly the grassroots piece for people who are residents of a local community, are on these neighborhood councils as well, the local community. So this is from in the context of civic engagement. So we've already gotten 5 local neighborhood councils who have taken strong positions, and they've called upon the LAPD to rescind and to terminate these programs, which is very huge because, you know, local communities want to have good relationships with the police. And for them to step up and really call out these programs, which are slated as counterterrorism, was a huge step. Then we also got the LA cities for the first time anywhere in the country. The LA City's Human Relations Commission passed a motion about a year ago, and then they are slated to start these hearings and forums now. And after 6 months of deliberation, in which they also invited LAPD's own deputy chief and head of counterterrorism, they invited the LAPD inspector general. But after listening to and seeing all the reports, the research that we had done, and community testimony, the Human Relations Commission passed a motion as well that they would hold public hearings and forums on these programs as well. So in essence, I think the first step is really critical, because all of these things and even what I've shared with you can be complex. It could be dense as well. So I think the first really goal, it's taken us about 3 years almost to start, even when we say surveillance, spying, and infiltration, to take that mindset out of this James Bond kind of espionage kind of thing into, like, no, it's not any specialized operation like we think of the FBI and COINTELPRO and the NSA, but instead of a specialized operation, it's everyday, normal, tactical, 24/7 operation that our local law enforcement engages in. So I think that's really the first step where people have these aha moments and they say, wait a minute, like, you know, I thought this was only COINTELPRO and this happened, or I thought this was only the FBI and I have nothing to hide, so why should I worry about it? Well, that's fine. It's not about you, nothing to hide. It's what happens with your information. Then it's this being shared. So basically your lives are being bared all across.
I've been sending you information as it's coming across on the targeting, which is coming out of, you can see screenshots, and again, these will be linked, but talking about a website called Cop Talk, there are reports that is linked to the police department personnel. I don't know. I don't know whether that's being confirmed yet or not. It will be. You're making that very clear that it will be.
I saw those links. And, you know, I mean, the language that is sometimes like, whoa, I mean, that goes to show what the real sentiment is. And you know, this whole facade of protect and serve is rather into, like, you know, just, I don't know, invade and occupy, basically.
The show before yours was from the West Bank, and the similarities between occupied territory that Sam, our guest, in, and what's going on right now, absolutely terrifying on some levels, and on other levels, to watch how they are not beaten, we are not beaten.
No, absolutely. And just like, I'll take it a step further, Terry, just like you're saying, that these are the tactics of people who are afraid, they're cowards, they're bullies, and they know that, you know, that people's power is much bigger than anything else, so, and we've seen that historically as well. So I think we need to really just claim this moment as this expression of people's power as well. We need to claim this moment that, you know, wherever there's oppression, there's also very strong resistance as well. So, you know, we keep on digging in, and it's only that, and, you know, for us to let folks up in St. Louis know that, you know, we're there. I mean, we are here, we're in solidarity, we are in partnership, and I think that solidarity and partnership needs to go beyond claims and statements as well, with actual practice of our own information sharing, of our own collective learning, of our own shared research and process, of our own shared tactics, and how do we continue to resist and dismantle this monster?
Godspeed to that. It is truly a remarkable machine that's been assembled with our own resources. This is our tax money. We're not the enemy. We are Americans. But That's got about 20 minutes left in the show, and I think that's really where we need to take a look, if you could help us here, please. Because of the militarization of police forces, because of that paradigm, you stop thinking in terms of these are the people that you live with, and you start thinking in terms of this is the enemy. That is the essence of militarization. So we've hit a couple of words here that's a big part of Fusion Center. Real quick, and again, there'll be links, but COINTEL goes way back for counterintelligence. And again, that's a military term. It means to be able to control spies. And we keep hearing the word spy. Can you give us what's your thoughts there?
So maybe what would be helpful real quickly in a minute or so to even look at what the stated intent or the claim or the practice of COINTELPRO or counterintelligence programs were. But I would even take it a step further, Pateri, and maybe bring in the development of the police red squads. Because COINTELPRO came way after the development of police red squads. The FBI came in the early 1900s. But we need to go back to something very close to you all in Chicago when the first fight for eight-hour workdays began. And if you remember back in 1886, I believe, that the Haymarket strikes happened. And as a result of the Haymarket strikes, which were where the fight was for an eight-hour workday, the police came down and they kind of put down very violently as well. And there was some bomb went off, and there's a lot of stories about who were the informants, who were the infiltrators, who were the instigators. But in essence, what came out of that was that within 2 years, Chicago Police Department, had started working on developing a covert department within the police departments where they said that, our fight has now become ideological in nature. So by which they mean that people are now beginning to fight for their human rights and their basic rights as well, because there was workers were being abused, there was no thing of they could be worked to death, basically, and literally people died. So now this ideological warfare had begun, which was financed and funded by the robber barons, basically. So that was the development of the police red squads, which was the issue was that they would infiltrate, and now so there's a whole I would recommend to your audience this book called Protectors of Privilege by Frank Donner, who kind of traces the history of local police red squads and how they operated, where in essence there was a time in the city of Los Angeles, for example, that the city's the LAPD's own red squad was based out of the Chamber of Commerce. It wasn't based out of LAPD, it was based out of Chamber of Commerce. It was also 87% of their budget came from the Manufacturers and Retailers Association. There's also a history that where these cops would go, and anytime there was an organizing effort that was going on in the port of Los Angeles or other places, they would actually be infiltrating, they would gather information, and they would sell it to business owners as well. So that's really the precursor of what we look at the FBI and the COINTELPRO. So the culture of infiltration and the culture of information gathering was already in place. And, of course, who was considered the enemy? At that time, again, the stated claim was that it's the anarchists, it's these foreigners, it's these people who are coming and communists are coming and all that. But it was really people who were fighting for basic rights. Same thing when you see, when fast forward, you go into COINTELPRO. And then they said, well, the communists are coming. But then when you find out, it was practiced as to dismantle, to disrupt, to discredit, and neutralize movements for social justice. The first target in 1956 was the Puerto Rican liberation movement, then the black liberation movement, then, the Chicano liberation movement, the American Indian movement, and then, poor people and working people and this and that and everything else. But constantly it was told that it's the communists are coming. So again, now, when you look at that history of COINTELPRO, now the terrorists are coming. But under the guise of terrorism, even the U.S. Senate audit on the Fusion Center said that half of the Fusion Centers didn't even have a counterterrorism mandate. So they were basically picking up information on criminal activity and stuff like that. So
1033, that we'll have a link to the CNN testimony that you've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Not CNN, C-SPAN, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And they specifically say in there that 1033 money is not to be used for riots.
Mm-hmm.
So their oversight is, by their own admission, lax. How's that for an understatement?
Lax, or I would even say that, why even give them an inch? I mean, it's intentional. And I think this is, again, so Ferguson, like some people have made an argument that, that there are also people within law enforcement as well who are extremely upset that St. Louis showed such a tremendous amount of force. But I think we can also make an argument that this is also intentional as well. This was their opportunity to really show the use of force and kind of keep, over time, keep on incorporating it and justifying this as well. So we'll see where this goes, but we've seen how legislative agendas move, but yet at the same time, what happens practically is completely different than what is stated.
We've got 14 minutes left. Can you, specifically what we're dealing with here is MIAC. MIAC is Michigan, not Michigan. MIAC is the Missouri Intelligence,
yeah,
and they have a unique history. That was the group that had to retract a statement they had put out that Ron Paul, people who voted for Ron Paul or people who had Ron Paul stickers, were terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us any idea of what we're dealing with in the St. Louis area there?
Well, again, what you're dealing with is that how information had been gathered, people through multiple agencies, through multiple ways, whether it was through the suspicious activity reporting program, or whether it was through infiltrators, or whether it was through informants, or whether it was through other forms of electronic surveillance. But in essence, what happens is, in these kind of cases, that what they, and this goes back to, we have to link the issue of the Patriot Act over here as well. If you remember,
right,
that passed within 6 weeks of 9/11, which really completely redefined, and we also need to take it maybe a year before that as well, that after the battle in Seattle happened, if you remember that.
Yes.
WTO. So that WTO protest and the Battle of Seattle was an assessment that was made that how the state and the U.S. government started redefining domestic terrorism as well. That even a simple act of throwing a stone is a potential act of domestic terrorism as well. So I think, so this is what happens, that going back to the very long history of protest culture in the United States, they are looking to demonize that. And what they're doing is they're looking to completely render us as, like, just people who would not even move. Like, now even freedom of speech is being curtailed as well. So that's what they do, that if somebody or anybody even utters a word, somebody even says something, that goes into the data center, that is seen as a potential act of domestic terrorism, or a planning an act of domestic terrorism, and then it shows up as, it gets rearticulated and reclaimed as potential terrorists. So I think that's where this comes from as well. So there's a direct link with how, and even before the Patriot Act, I would even go back to 1996, the Effective Death Penalty Anti-Terrorism Act, which was right on the heels of Oklahoma City, that was passed as well. So I think it's almost like, what is happening now, what you're talking about, is, again, we need to look at, and it's very, very important for all of us in our organizing and our understanding, that these are not just moments in time, but it's a continuation of history. All of these things harken back to the 1888 Red Squad formation, and even prior to that as well, you talk about the law enforcement. Well, police originally started out as slave catchers. So, what the history of police when you start looking at it as well. So these are organized, departments that we can link them back to hundreds of years. And that whole operation, of course, with technology and tactical weaponry and communications and infrastructure has evolved over time, but quite frankly, the intent and practice remains the same.
I've got about 10 minutes left. Could you use about 5 minutes of it giving us a real quick overview of just what specifically is InfraGuard? Because to me, that's one of the most wide open, no controls. It's absolutely terrifying how that can be misused and might be being misused is the point.
Right. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
That was it, please. What do we need to know in the St. Louis area?
Yeah, these are, again, operations and things that have been used, that these are basically partnerships that have been set up between various law enforcement, federal law enforcement agencies, and these are basically just a way to bring in the private sector, a large section of the academia as well, a large section of where the stated claim, my understanding is, that what they say is to protect the infrastructures and protect against terrorist attack and protect against, to be prepared for any natural disasters and what have you. But in essence, what continues to happen is that, there is so much money that is being thrown in, that everything that is happening now in Ferguson, think of that this becomes and I'm just kind of, throw it more as what we could see in the future as well, is that this is also being the all the resistance and the organizing that is happening on the street is also being studied by the academia as well, which is in partnership with FBI and Homeland Security and these agencies as well, that how do they keep on fine-tuning. So think of it not just from a structural point of view through tactical weaponry and all that, but also think of it more as a psychological warfare as well. So when we think of the military psychops, as the term is used, it's a comprehensive structural, comprehensive research, a very comprehensive academic, a very comprehensive private sector, a very comprehensive state sector partnership that kind of looks at all of the whole landscape in its fullest and its deepest as well. And through that are then programs and policies get evolved, which are not only then to strengthen the state and strengthen the weaponry and strengthen the technology and strengthen the use of human intelligence and electronic intelligence, but also it develops policies and programs which would pacify the communities as well. So think of it
yes.
more like from the counterterrorism perspective as well. That what they do is, or counterinsurgency perspective as well. That one of the things, for example, and I'll draw these parallels in the United States and war abroad as well. That what the U.S. does is that, for example, when they go to Afghanistan or Iraq or other places, they identify some leaders in the community as well. And then
yes.
they bribe them, then they become their conduits and eyes and ears to the community as well. So, which then helps them in monitoring and which further leads to pacification as well. So I think one of the pieces that we need to be pushing this is that we need to be very careful, and it was really awesome to see in Ferguson that how the youth especially kicked the traditional civil rights leadership out of there, like, no more bullshit, no more talk, we need action. So I think that's what we need to be looking at, that how, in a very tactical way, in a very planned way, these operations are used to be engaging in psychological warfare as well, and how then this whole terminology of community policing, for example, emerges, that all collaborative policing emerges, that, okay, but when you look at the practice, well, it's not about community policing, it's about policing the community. So that's where these groups like InfraGuard and some of these other groups come into play, where they develop this massive network of research and analysis and information gathering, and then kind of come up with tactical operations. They come up with policies and programs which are not just limited to the operational side of it, but very much as to the human side of it too. Then what would psychological warfare look like?
6 minutes left, and that is possibly one of the most important things you can get across to our people who are really getting tired. This is 2.5 months that this, for lack of a better term, siege has been going on. this psychological warfare is designed to make the battlefield in your mind, and that is not to be underestimated. That is the ultimate battleground for the people who have studied it. What can our people there in Ferguson, they're really feeling worn down, are there psychological, again, for lack of a better word, inoculations that can help you ward off the effects of, we know we're getting post-traumatic stress disorder out of this. You can see it in the tweets. I think you've seen some of them I was sending you from the victims. What do you want to tell them there, please?
Really appreciate and just thank them and being such models for all of us and, you know, just to be there in solidarity. But I think also to see that what's going to happen post this. I mean, how does this energy and this vibe and this resilience turn into an ongoing direct action and direct intervention and direct protection and defense of our communities as well. And along with that, while people are throwing down their bodies and on the line, I think what we have a moral obligation out here who are not in Ferguson, who are not there directly physically present, but we have a moral obligation that how do we support and partner with communities over there as well. So we'd be happy to speak to folks. Any research that we have done at the Stop LAPD Spine Coalition, we invite people to go to the website, the Stop LAPD, it's www.stoplapdspine.org, one word, stoplapdspine.org. There's tons of information over there. There's the U.S. Senate audit. There's also a report from the National Academy of Sciences that we found that really goes to the heart of some of the claims that the national security apparatus uses around behavioral surveillance and data mining. So I think it is through this we need to kind of develop our own information sharing as well. The idea is that how do we constantly keep on flipping the script? And how do we constantly keep on taking it back? And it's not something that we are completely a pie in the sky or smoke, that we are making things up or pulling it out of thin air. These are actual documents. These are actual research. And it's so interesting, Terry, that a lot of it comes from the government agencies themselves. So I think how do we then use that in combination with the people power? And, you know, that's a powerful combination, and that's where we come in also as partners and in solidarity as to however we don't want to, I mean, absolutely not parachute in, but we are here and we are very much available.
We've got 2 minutes, 30 seconds left. Optimism. Please leave us one of the most important tools that our opponents, I did not use the word enemy, that our opponents are using against us is learned helplessness, the feeling that no matter what you do, it won't work.
I would rather present it a little differently, Terry, because what we have seen has worked. What we have seen has absolutely put people's power on the map. What we have seen is exposed the complete, this huge apparatus into you know everybody's mental frame as well and psychological frame too. That yes, rather than people cowering down. So I think I would rather say that it is definitely a huge issue of trauma and emotional impact on the communities as well. But quite frankly, the young people in are really our models and, you know, just looking at the future. I'm extremely hopeful that, you know, where people are going. And I see that same model in Los Angeles, you know, groups like the Youth Justice Coalition and other groups as well who are doing some tremendous work. So I'm actually pretty hopeful that it's really they are putting the police state and state violence on notice that, whatever you do, you're not gonna silence us because we're gonna keep on coming back at you. So I think that's for us, like you know, people who have been there on the front lines in the past and would strive to continue in the present as well. That's what we should be looking for. That where the youth are and take that leadership from the youth and support them in any which way possible.
The world is watching, and we stand with Ferguson. We stand with Stop Spying LAPD. I want to thank you for standing. I'm sorry. There'll be a link to it because the people who've listened to this show know I screw up a lot. So we'll have a link up so they can get to it without me messing it up. I really want to thank you for your help.
Absolutely.
Thanks for standing and keep it up.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much, Terry. Thanks for the opportunity, and much love to everybody out there, and just keep it up, and you are our model there.